Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, Bears, Babies, and Religion. For the last quarter century, Dr. Reginald Bibby of the University of Lethbridge has been polling the social values and attitudes of Canadians, and he's breathed life into his data by publishing the results in popular books. And next on his plate is one about religion. And Sophie Chetwertinsky goes bear hunting. This PhD student at the University of Alberta spent her summer collaring bears for a major study on bear cub survivorship. And Dr. Nicola Cherry of the University of Alberta has just published her major study on male infertility. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Back in 1975, Reg Bibby's interest in sociology prompted a survey of social issues and deviance in Canadian society. What was supposed to be a one-time poll has turned into a major recurring study for this sociology professor at the University of Lethbridge. In 1995, his study included more than 400 people who had participated in the original 1975 survey. Just appointed the research chair for social sciences at the University of Lethbridge, Dr. Bibby is presently working on a book that looks at what has happened with our attitudes about religion over the last quarter century.
Well, we've tried to deal with a number of common notions that people have, and because I suppose in some ways that's just was our starting place. We had some stereotypes as to where people were. And what became interesting with the results that we were generating going back to 1975 was simply finding that things were not necessarily the way people were putting them together. For example, we've been monitoring the involvement that Canadians have in organized religion going back to 1975. And so we can tell you about, you know, what the levels were like then versus what they're like now, and have been documenting a general decline as far as participation in organized religion. But in the next breath, we've also been looking at the extent to which Canadians are receptive to organized religion. And what we've been finding throughout the entire time is that they've not dropped out. They've continued to identify with the major religious groups in the country. We've also found that even though attendance at this point in time is down to about 21%, we're talking here weekly attenders, at the same time, a high level of receptivity among Canadians as far as organized religion goes. Something else we've been able to address is, apart from organized religion, to what extent Canadians are interested in spirituality, for example, or the extent to which, again, stereotypes I know that I had when I started out this research program, the extent to which they engage in things like private prayer, the extent to which they actually value religion as such, some of these more subjective things, but also some of the behavioral things, and definitely beliefs. Up through 1975, when we had started the research program, we really didn't know much in Canada about the extent to which Canadians are holding conventional beliefs in God, divinity of Jesus, life after death, these kinds of things. And we certainly didn't know much about the less conventional, the extent to which Canadians are giving credibility to ESP and psychic phenomena and reading their horoscopes and so on. So we've been generating a lot of data in those kinds of areas. What we've been finding overall is that if we look at the extent to which Canadians participate in organized religion, by now it's so obvious that those levels are far below the interest that they have with respect to interest in spirituality, interest in less conventional things, but also the extent to which they hold very conventional beliefs about God. The God level, for example, as far as belief over time has been hanging steady at somewhere between about 80% and 90%. Perhaps more surprising is we've been finding over time that when we even ask Canadians about the extent to which they actually think they've experienced God, that level has remained steady at around 45% since 1975, during which time attendance dropped from somewhere around 35% down to around 20%.
Where does this movement in New Age religion or the movement to accept spirituality as becoming almost second place, where does that fit into the scheme of things?
Well, interesting. There's a number of ways I could respond. I would say that the interest in New Age ideas has been fairly pronounced. That interest has been fairly pronounced over the last, say, 20 years or so. Canadians, though, have really been a la carte, like in the way that they approach things like New Age religion and New Age offerings. And so they might be very interested in something like channeling, and they might buy a little pyramid, as even I did one time, and put it beside my bed for the heck of it, and might be interested in those sorts of things. They certainly are reading their horoscopes and so on. But what we find is that they adopt those kinds of things in bits and pieces, while at the same time continuing to think, for the most part in Canada, that they're Protestants or they're Roman Catholics. The interest in spirituality, I think, is, and again, nothing overly profound here with me, but I would say that a major source of that has been the legitimation that spirituality has been receiving from the media, particularly, and included in that the extent to which high-profile entertainers, athletes, and so on appear on things like talk shows and talk about their spirituality. So spirituality, as many people have been noting, has really been in the last 10 or 15 years, has contributed to a climate where people now can, in a very open way, talk about spirituality, express spiritual needs, and not be laughed at as they may have been in the 60s.
When you look at the Canadian landscape and the Canadian history, religion has played a very important role. People have come here in order to express religious freedom, but at the same time there's also been a lot of taboos in terms of the mixing of religions, and yet now we're going through a period where we have a lot of people coming from countries all over the world who bring all kinds of different religious beliefs here. Are we mixing at all in terms of our religious beliefs?
Well, it's an important question. If we're talking about the extent to which other religions are making headway over against Christianity in the country, that's really been a very slow kind of a process for groups. To give you an idea, back in 1871, when our first census was carried out, only 2% of Canadians were identifying with other faiths. Up through 1971, the figure had reached a mammoth 4%, with the difficulty being that many people coming to Canada simply were having difficulty in being able to instill that other faith kind of expression in their children. The problem here is a numbers one, because I should, by the way, just update that and say between 71 and 91, there certainly has been an increase in as far as people coming from countries bringing other faiths with them. As a result of that, in 1971, the other faith figure had moved up to around 7%. The difficulty that these other faiths tend to have is that they simply are small in as far as numbers, and as a result, when we're looking, for example, at kids in Canada who are have parents who are Sikhs, we're talking about kids who only have access to about 0.5% of Canadians when it comes to marrying within the faith. And that's true of virtually any of the other faiths. Even the Jewish figures in Canada are relatively small, some 1-2% of Canadians over time. So these groups face a very, very difficult battle in terms of being able to retain their children over time. We found as recently as 1991 that when we look at intermarriage patterns, to the extent that people identify with other world faiths and marry, say, a Protestant or a Catholic, the kids tend to be raised as Protestants or Catholics. Heavens, if they marry someone who says, I'm no religion, the kids tend to be raised no religion. And so this is just a practical demographic reality. These groups are small in number, and as a result, they have great difficulty in being able to actually increase their numbers over time. What we have on the positive side in terms of diversity is there's no question that is, people are coming from other countries, particularly from third world countries where people see themselves as Catholics. They're adding very much to the cultural mosaic of Catholicism. When we see evangelicals coming from places like Korea, they're adding to the mosaic of Protestantism in Canada. But for the most part, the big religious companies in Canada continue to enjoy quite a monopoly.
Have there been any surprises for you coming out of this last research?
I would say that particularly with the youth research, what we have been surprised to see is an upturn in attendance among 15 to 19-year-olds. In 1984, we had about 22% of teens attending on a weekly basis. That dropped to 15% in 1992. I thought it would go down around 10% as of 2000. But no, lo and behold, it rebounded up to close to that 22% figure from 1984. That's definitely been a surprise. Also, in our adult and youth surveys, we've asked Canadians bluntly, would you consider being more involved in groups if you found it to be worthwhile? And what we're finding is that over 50% of Canadians who are not attending on even a monthly basis say that they'd be receptive to greater involvement. Among teens, the figure is somewhere around 40%. That surprised me in the sense that I tend to get caught up in a lot of the thinking of everyone else and assuming that if people are not involved, they probably are not that interested in organized religion, and hence we invariably will say yes, but they're interested in spirituality. So a surprising finding here is the finding that a high percentage of Canadians, both young and old, are indicating that they are receptive, that there's an opportunity for religious groups, that they haven't given up on religious groups, but the onus is still on religious groups to come through.
Well, those are the facts and figures, but what's the motivation behind it? What is motivating people to try and find themselves within a religious group?
Well, I think it comes down here to real pragmatism, even if they wouldn't verbalize it quite like that. And I think that it's a matter that all of us give our time and we give our resources more generally to the kinds of things that we regard as significant. There's no question but that Canadians are saying, and we've documented this again right up through 2000, they're saying that they're intrigued with the issues relating to what's going to happen to me when I die, what's the purpose of life, the meaning of suffering, how can I find all of my happiness, these kinds of things. They're raising those questions at least off and on. I think what's important is to the extent that they can feel that those kinds of issues can be addressed by religious groups, then they're going to define religious groups as significant and they're going to want to have more to do with them. The practical problem right now is that religious groups have got to find ways of being able to convey to Canadians that if in fact they have something to bring to them with respect to these big questions that are being raised, that groups have got to be able to somehow get the message across that they do have something relevant to say, they have something pertinent to say. And I think there's almost a match made in heaven. There's an ongoing demand on the part of Canadians for many of the things that religious groups have stressed historically. And the issue here is, can religious groups respond in a way that will allow them to be able to simply be relevant to Canadians? And can they get that message across in the course of time so that there's going to be a connecting of churches and Canadians?
It sounds like they have to take a new marketing approach.
I think they probably do. They've got to, if they really believe they've got a product and products that can address these kinds of interests and needs of Canadians, then they clearly have got to get the word out as well that they in fact do have them. And at this point in time, there's obviously a perception on the part of many Canadians that even though they identify with the groups, even though they indicate that they're receptive to greater involvement, clearly a lot of Canadians are not defining the groups as doing the kinds of things that'll make it worthwhile for them to be involved.
When does your book on religious trends come out?
It's coming out in April, and it's called Restless Gods. Some people who might be familiar with my work know that we've had fragmented gods and we've had unknown gods in the past, and this one is Restless Gods, the Renaissance of Religion in Canada.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Reginald Bibby, author and sociology professor at the University of Lethbridge. He has just been appointed to the newly created research chair for social sciences at the university. Coming up, Sophie's Bears. This summer, Sophie Chetwertinsky spent her time on the Air Weapons Range at Cold Lake. Her mission was to capture as many black bears as she could. Armed only with pails and a pile of sweet stuff, she snafu'd over 200 bears. In fact, some of them came back more than once, despite getting their paws caught in a snare or a radio collar snapped around their necks. As part of her PhD research, Sophie is leading a 4-year study on the impact of access and hunting on black bear populations in Alberta. Her partners include everyone from guides and outfitters to energy and forest companies.
Well, probably has something to do with the topic of the study. The effects of hunting on black bears is something that's fairly controversial. As many people have heard, the spring hunt has been banned in Ontario and in several states in the U.S. as well. But this will be really the first study that is trying to isolate the effects of hunting and really see what the biological effects are before making any kind of conclusions based on simple observations, but not sound biological data.
How exactly have you designed this study?
The design is actually something that's really interesting. What we've been able to do is have four study areas, two of which are in hunted areas and two of which are in the Cold Lake Air Weapons Range, where hunting isn't allowed. And because we're participating with hunting groups and the outfitters, we're actually going to be able to do an experimental manipulation, which is something that's very difficult to do when you're talking about mammals that cover such extensive extensive territories. So after 2 years of following bears with radio collars, what we're going to do is stop hunting in one of the two hunted areas and remove some of the bears in one of the study areas in the unhunted population, and in that way really be able to isolate the effects of hunting.
Now, you've spent your summer just trying to find the bears that you need for the study and put collars on them. Tell me a little bit about that. You must have had some adventures.
Some adventures and some close calls, but in the end, everything worked out very well. We've presently got 87 bears that are equipped with radio collars, and that's after having about somewhere around 220 bear captures this summer. So everything went pretty well, and really didn't lose any field crews, so as far as I can say, everything worked out just fine.
You're putting collars on these bears in order to track their movements. Why are you using different types of collars?
Well, we're using both GPS, global satellite positioning collars, and VHF, which are the conventional collars. The reason for that is that we want to look at both demographics and behavior. GPS collars are very expensive, and so we can only use a certain amount of them. And what we want to do with those collars is really look at fine-scale habitat use by bears, whereas the VHF collars are going to be used to get a larger sample size on some demographic variables, such as female nutritional condition, reproduction, and cub survivorship.
Are there different ideas about how bears move around or how they use their habitat that you're testing out here?
Yes, that's exactly it. Right now, there's competing hypotheses of what the effects of hunting or the removal of large adult males from the population could be. There's one hypothesis states that these large adult males are probably the ones that cause a lot of the cub mortality. They also kill females. And so removing these large adult males from a population might cause the immigration of younger subadult males, and overall might reduce cub mortality and increase even population densities in certain areas. Now, there's a completely opposite hypothesis, and what this one states is that these large adult males are actually resident bears, so they don't kill cubs that are within their home range. But actually, by removing these large adult males, you get new subadults that come in, and the first thing that they're going to do is kill the cubs so that they may sire their own cubs with the females that are within that area. And a consequence of this, and this is why we want to look at habitat selection, is that there's a possibility that males might be, or that females might be avoiding new immigrant males that come into the territory, and that might reduce their nutritional condition. And so by using a larger amount of VHF collars, something we're going to be able to see is to go into the dens in the winter and look at female nutritional condition, reproduction, and also cub survivorship.
What are the traps like that you're using?
Well, to catch a bear, if you want to picture what you have to do, what you really want to do is get a snare around its paw, and that's how you catch bears for research projects. The important thing, and something that we've really tried to do, is to make sure that the bears don't get injured. So the snares that we have designed are not only rubber padded, but have all edges taken off, have everything from shock absorbers to drags. And so we want to make sure that the bears we do catch aren't injured from the experience.
Once you get out there and you find them, then what do you do if you've got a bear in there so that you can take the measurements and get the collar on?
Well, the first thing we do is really just assess the situation and see how dangerous it is. And usually the bears, by the time you get there, are pretty tangled up, so they don't have too much room to move. And all you do is you make sure you have a bodyguard, and he's got a shotgun just in case something goes wrong. And you've also got another person with just a little CO2, either a CO2 pistol or just a jab stick. And basically what you do is you want to either dart the bear or slowly inject the drug with a stick, depending on how tangled the bear is. And then it takes them about somewhere from 5 to 10 minutes to go to sleep.
What do you do with all that information?
You can do some incredible stuff right now with using digital maps. You can actually look at the type of habitats that bears are using over the entire summer. And then we're going to be able to compare the habitat use of females, males, and also compare that between hunted and unhunted populations.
Thank you very much, Sophie.
Thank you.
That was biologist Sophie Chetwertynski, a PhD candidate at the University of Alberta. Coming up, solvents and male infertility. For some couples, conceiving a baby is next to impossible. All kinds of things can affect reproductive success. What Dr. Nicola Cherry has been looking at over the past decade is the role solvents play in male fertility. Her research has just recently been published in the Journal of Occupational and Environmental Medicine. Dr. Cherry is now at the University of Alberta, heading up the Occupational Health Program in the Faculty of Medicine and Dentistry.
I was working at McGill at the time in Montreal, and we were doing studies of the effects of occupation on the outcome of pregnancy. And it occurred to us that if they didn't get pregnant, they didn't have any outcome. And so we set up a study to look at the effects of the work environment, and particularly organic solvents, on the fertility of men in Montreal.
Now, why solvents?
Well, the reproductive system is really very well protected. So we're only interested in substances that can get through that protection, through that barrier. And we knew that solvents, which can get through fat and can get into cells and through cells, could get into the reproductive tract in men. So we knew it was a possible substance that we ought to have a look at.
How did you go about the study?
We found a clinic associated with McGill that had been looking at infertile couples for many years. And so we went back through their records, looked at the occupations that they were doing, and got an international panel to look at those jobs and to decide the degree of solvent exposure. And from there, we carried out the analysis to see whether those whose fertility was very poor were more likely to have exposure to solvents at work than those whose fertility appeared to be quite good.
And what did you find?
Well, we found within the McGill sample, we found that there was an increased risk of very poor sperm count the higher the level of solvent exposure. And then we were able to confirm that by looking at men from clinics across Canada. And again, we found that the high levels of solvent exposure were associated with an increased risk of a poor sperm count.
Are there certain areas of the country that have higher incidences than others?
That's not a question we can answer from this study. In practice, using the 11 clinics that we used for the follow-up study, people have looked at this, and this is from McMaster, and they found that in some areas of the country, sperm counts seem to be going up, and some seem to be going down, and some just the same. So there was no consistent pattern across Canada.
Well, once you got your results, did your analysis and that, what does that tell you about what's happening in the workplace and what people are being exposed to?
Well, the results, as I say, were quite consistent between the two studies, that people exposed to high levels of solvents, particularly in painting and printing, seem to have a poor sperm count. And that suggests that, which we've always told people, that they should be very careful when they're working with solvents. Because solvents don't only have an effect on the reproductive system, they can also affect the nervous system. You've seen pictures of young people who sniff glues. What they're doing then is they're sniffing solvents, and their behaviour is affected. So we have to treat solvents very carefully. They're not water. If you're using them, you should be careful not to breathe them in or to have them on your skin because they can be absorbed through the skin.
What's been the result of this work that you've done?
Well, the first result that took some time was that we are now doing a much more detailed study. In fact, in the UK, because I went from Montreal to the UK before coming to Alberta, and that study will be completed within the next few months. And in that, we're trying to find exactly which solvents it is. It's very easy to say it's organic solvents, but it doesn't help us very much. What we want to know is is a particular solvent or one or two solvents that are harmful and that can be substituted so that people don't have this risk anymore.
So how are you trying to determine that?
We're taking couples, the men of the couple we're particularly interested in, as they come to the fertility clinic, before they know whether it's a problem with the man or the woman or both, and we're taking blood samples, all sorts of other biological samples, and we're analysing those to see if we can identify the solvents that are in the blood of a man who has particular problems conceiving.
Do you have any ideas at this point as to which way it's leaning?
We don't have any results from that study yet. From the review of the literature, there's a group of substances called glycol ethers that in animal studies there is an effect on reproduction, and we certainly know that some sorts of paints and printing inks have glycol ethers in them. So that would obviously be a prime suspect, but we really don't have the answers to the new study at the moment.
Now, the work that you did has just recently been published in one of the medical journals. Why does it take so long for it to come out?
I'm afraid this is one of the difficulties of research. You do the analysis, you present the data at a scientific conference, people ask you to do more research, and very sadly, from time to time, the substantive paper doesn't reach the literature for some time. But I'm very glad it has, and it's caused a great deal of interest, so that is appropriate that it should have been published now.
What brought you to Alberta to do research?
I was approached by Alberta, who was looking for somebody to take on the job of head of the occupational medicine program. Occupational medicine is a rather small specialty. There aren't many people in the world, and I was known to people in Canada because I had worked at McGill, and indeed I'd qualified in medicine at McGill. So I was one of the first people they thought of for this job.
Well, certainly with the petrochemical and all the energy production in Alberta that goes on, there has from time to time been concerns raised about health effects on the population. Is this something that you will be looking at?
As you know, I'm new to Alberta, and I'm just, in a sense, bringing myself up to speed on what research has been done. I know some has been done looking at the effect on the breathing, the respiratory health of people living near the oil industry. And at the moment, there's a study going on looking at beef cattle and seeing if the flaring and other events from the oil industry affects their reproductive outcome, or indeed whether the wildlife is affected. So these studies are going on, and I should be very interested to see what comes out of them.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I was speaking with Dr. Nicola Cherry. She's a professor of public health sciences and head of the occupational health program at the University of Alberta. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Check out our website. You can listen to past programs in real audio or download them from the web. That's at innovationalberta.ckua.com. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.